Welcome to our podcast, Coffee Science for Coffeepreneurs.
I'm Ida Steen, and I will talk about sensory methodology and education.
I'm Morten Münchow, and I'll talk about coffee roasting. Welcome to this podcast episode with Peter Giuliano. And I'm really excited to speak with you because it's actually some years ago that we have spoken, right? And we did speak quite a lot around the merger, but then things happened, luckily nothing more happened, and now we're just talking again. So Peter, as you know, we have in Coffee Mind been working a lot with education and research for many years, and that's obviously also the subject of today. But first, I just want to know, how are you?
Yeah, I'm well. It's good to see you, and it's good to be speaking with you again. As a lot has happened in the past few years, you know, and so it's great to be reconnecting with you and get to talk about this subject. You know, this is a subject. The idea of research, scientific research in coffee, is a subject that's near and dear to me. And you ask how I am, and I'm enthusiastic. I'm happy because this has become such an important topic for coffee. That is the idea of integrating scientific knowledge with what we do.
Yeah, that's great. And
how are you?
Well, I'm good. Surviving the pandemic, as education has been. The fact that we are still here is really not something that I take for granted. So that's a good thing.
Yeah.
But a lot of interesting things has happened in terms of the business models. So the whole online thing is just much more fun than I even imagined.
Oh, that's great.
So I'm doing live roasting courses now, 7 hours, where people get 3 hours of e-learning before and then 7 hours of hands-on roasting. And I do it in U.S. time zone. So I'm starting at 4 p.m. and ending at 11 p.m. when it's U.S. time zones, and then European and Asians on different machines.
Wow.
And it's actually been the most fun ever. There's something about that format that just works extremely well for the students. And also for me, I'm forced to be much more structured for it to work online, which is great for me because I'm very creative. And so that has really been really great. So of course, bad things happen. There's a lot of good things happening. So it's much more fun to think about the next 10 years now than it was before the pandemic from a kind of business perspective. So that's basically how we are. And we are ending. We've submitted the first article in Ida's PhD that is in for peer review right now. And we plan on ending it in January. She's got 2 kids while. So luckily, we had extra time to rethink the project a lot of times, and that was actually needed. Without the 2 kids, I'm not sure we would have made it. So that was another lucky thing that happened. So, but that's the research project that we are spending most time on now, because that's the Coffee Mind industrial PhD. So obviously, that's shaping the company a lot. What's happening there?
Great. Well, please let me know as soon as that's published. I'd love to read it.
Yeah, sure. I will. Trust me. Great. Yeah. So, Peter, what I'm really curious about, since it's so long time that we've been talking, one of the things that I would like to, it's not the first question that I sent you, but it's I'm just curious. What has it been like since you established the new research foundation, and what kind of key projects and findings would you like to share with our listeners, just to basically get an idea of what's been going on? Because I've been a bit too busy to kind of really make sure that I got the whole thing or whatever. Yeah. So if you could just from the top of your mind talk about that.
Sure, I'd love to. So just as a reminder, what you're talking about is that when the SCAA and the SCAE merged, we had some goals and some dreams. And one of them was to establish a different kind of coffee research institution. Both organizations had their own research programs going at the time. And then what we tried to do with the merger is integrate them and launch something new called the Coffee Science Foundation, which is a different kind of nonprofit than the SCA, but it is, we think of it as the research arm of the SCA. But it's very engaged with academic research. That's its focus. So since then we've had, I don't have the number right off the top of my head, but it's, I think 9 or 10, we've been able to support, financially 9 or 10 different, research projects at various universities around the world in various different disciplines. To do with kind of sensory perception of coffee, some chemistry, some economics, some social science, and all of that is the goal of that is to create more empirical information for the especially coffee trade to use. And also to just sort of push forward the general scientific project of increasing overall knowledge in the world. And then to do some practical things like make our education better and more informed. Help increase knowledge for the especially coffee trade.
Yeah, and having the foundation, it's more flexible to get funding from various sources and combine into individual projects, right?
Exactly.
So it's not necessarily SCA funded, all of it, but some projects might be more or less funded.
Yep, that's right.
So that's the idea, right?
Yeah, and it's been fantastic. A number of companies have stepped up and said, look, we're committed to the idea of coffee science and we want to support it through applying our resources. So, you know, the first company with a big grant was Breville, who's a small home coffee equipment manufacturer. Toddy has helped us. Simonelli has made a couple of generous grants to us. Savor, which is a packaging company, which has really been wonderful. And because for two reasons, number one, it helps us create more information for the especially coffee world. Secondly, though, it brings us closer in the trade to scientists who are doing work. So one example of that, Sarah Yeager, who was a student at UC Davis working on our cold brew project, graduated from UC Davis and has now gone to work for Toddy as their coffee scientist. And that's a pipeline in between, you know, the coffee sciences from an academic perspective into the trade. And I think you and I probably agree that that's a really good thing, because to have more people who are familiar with scientific methodology helping answer questions in the coffee industry is a good thing.
For sure. And,
yeah.
And what about, so to be a bit more specific in the kind of subjects and the findings, sure, that's useful for the community, it would be great to just, it, and if you forget anything, it's no problem.
Yeah.
It's just
I think I can do it.
Your mind.
Did a big study of like a 4-year study looking at, we call it brewing fundamentals. We're looking at the very basics of coffee brewing science that come down from the 50s and 60s that we've been teaching. Things like the brewing control chart, the idea of using TDS and percentage of extraction to try to know something about coffee quality. We wanted to investigate all of those assumptions that lead up to that. The basics of brewing, the golden cup as it's called. And so that's our biggest project to date. That's led to 9 academic publications, which has been fantastic output. So that was really cool. We also we're in the middle of one, a study on cold brew, understanding the differences between brewing with high temperature water and low temperature water and kind of room temperature water, the sensory and chemical differences there. We're doing one about electrochemistry as a way to measure espresso instead of TDS, using electrochemistry and trying to build a understanding of the relationship between electrochemistry and sensory attributes in espresso. We did a study of labor conditions on specialty coffee farms to understand if there was a difference between sort of specialty coffee producing farms and non-specialty coffee producing farms when it came to labor conditions. So that's more of on the social sciences. We've just launched a study at the London School of Economics and the University of Naples that's looking into whether sustainability interventions have measurable impacts on quality of life and producer livelihoods. So you can see that it's a diverse set of projects that comprises a lot of different.
And here the foundation is a flexible model to kind of embrace all that. So
right.
And here you are basically setting down different kind of stakeholders and coming up with ad hoc project and fundings as you go, right?
Yeah, but there's a strategic element to it. So the SCA has a strategy and the strategy and also has a what's called a sustainable industry strategy. So this is where the SCA has looked at the needs of the industry and said, look, this is what we want to work on. And what the SCA has chosen to focus on is this concept of value. One element of specialty coffee is that the whole goal of it is that it brings more value to people's lives, consumers' lives, but it also brings more value to coffee producers' lives as well. And I think we're all aware that there's been a disconnect between those two things. While the specialty coffee industry has really prospered on the consuming side, that prosperity has not necessarily been matched on the coffee producing side. And that's a problem. So we need to understand more how value is created in specialty coffee in the first place and how that value gets distributed throughout the supply chain.
And it's interesting because I can see how this ties into your white paper of specialty as a differentiated product. Because
right.
The differentiation is the value, right?
Exactly.
And then if you focus on both intrinsics and intrinsic aspects of differentiation, then you can kind of the whole chain, supply chain, can kind of gain from that increased differentiation.
Exactly. And one of the biggest things, and it's the topic that sort of we gravitate to, you and I personally, but also the specialty coffee industry in general, we really start to focus on sensory attributes. And where those get valued is interesting. You know, the consumers value them, the sensory attributes. That's one reason why they choose specialty coffee. And we can understand that. The coffee trade also values that. So a coffee buyer, a coffee expert, values certain attributes. And those things can be measured empirically. So that's the intersection, really, of, like, say, sensory and consumer science and economics and agricultural economics. That is really very interesting to us at the moment. And that requires understanding how sensory measurement works, how consumer science works, but also you know, there's other institutions out there who we work with closely, like World Coffee Research, who's trying to understand that because they're trying to apply that to the genetic project of developing better coffee varieties, you know?
Yeah.
But it has to be interdisciplinary. And that's why the flexibility, as you call it, of our model is so helpful, because, but it is guided. It's not just random. It's not totally ad hoc. It's guided by a desire to make the specialty coffee world better in this very specific way.
I do have a question to the brewing, because that was a very interesting project indeed. I'm just, from an education point of view and an application in the industry, I haven't read all of it. I got one of the articles there might be something I missed, but could you kind of help us understand what's the practical implication for the new brew chart? What is it that the new model can do that the old one couldn't? Or is there anything that has kind of had implications for the brewing part. It's just I only do roasting and sensory, so
right.
Actually, this is outside my area. But I'm just okay. Curious.
Yeah. So the brewing control chart assumes that if you the kind of the philosophy behind it, and this was goes back to Lockhart in the 1950s, was that if you could measure TDS and then infer the percentage of extraction, because you know the recipe that you brewed with, if you could do those two things and sort of plot them on a chart, then you could predict what he called quality, which was which he meant consumer liking, by knowing those, by understanding those two outputs, TDS and percentage of extraction. So that was the first thing we needed to test, you know, is what are the sensory differences as you manipulate those two outputs, as you manipulate the inputs to get those outputs? How does that modulate the sensory characteristics of the coffee brew? That's number one. And so what we got was, and that's a descriptive task, right? So we brewed coffee hundreds of different ways all over different spots of the brewing control chart and understood how you maximize sweetness or acidity or bitterness or roast character or all these different attributes. Okay, that's the descriptive task. Then we took that same approach to consumer liking and tested this hypothesis that Lockhart had, that this box in the center was where consumers liked coffee most. And the interesting thing, that was a really interesting output, because when we did that, indeed, when we averaged all the consumers together, indeed, the tendency seemed to fall within that little box. However, you know enough about consumer science to know that doesn't necessarily tell you the whole truth, because in fact, when we did a clustering exercise, there was really two groups of consumers. One group who liked low TDS coffees and favored the sensory attribute of sweetness, and a second group that liked higher TDS coffees and more extremely extracted, either low extractions or high extractions that maximized acidity or bitterness. So these are people that like intense flavors and people that like mild flavors. Those were two groups that were very distinct from each other and also replicated very well. So what we had is two distinct groups that when you average them together, they wind up in the middle of the chart. However, when you look at them separately, they actually exist in two different places of the chart. Yeah. And that's a key insight about how consumer science can prevent you from making a mistake.
Yes, you know? Yes. Yeah, I think that's amazing to hear, because I the only thing I thought was missing in the old chart was the consumer part.
Right.
Which is not just assuming that one size fits all, kind of acknowledge that different consumers have different opinions. But I think it's an amazing thing to first do the descriptive thing so that you know what the consumers are actually reacting on, so that you can explain, as you did, you know,
exactly.
It's they are not just here, because you could just serve a lot of different coffees and, oh, they are here and they are there, but you don't know why. And that's from the descriptive.
Yeah.
So I think.
Yeah. So what we're winding up with is kind of two charts. A descriptive chart, which helps coffee baristas navigate around the flavors in their coffee. And now our consumer, I wouldn't call it a consumer chart yet, because we did, you know, one study with 180 consumers in one geography in California. So I think we can do a lot more research on that before we have like a real consumer chart. Particularly in geographically diverse areas, because there is, for example, there's an assumption that European consumers, particularly in Northern Western Europe, where you live, like stronger coffee than elsewhere. Be interesting to quantify that.
That's amazing, because I think as a tool, it's interesting, but not necessarily possible to make a finite consumer study, right? So in a exactly. sense, I think it's amazing with the chat and also the descriptive work. And in a sense, then if I have a coffee shop here in Valby, I would need to expose my customers to different coffees, and then I would make my consumer chat about my specific audience in this, and then I'm done, right? I don't care about South Korea or Australia, because I just care about my consumers.
Right.
So that I think this is really a way to this is an amazing tool to help to be specifically helpful for the community. And this is one of the things, and probably also hearing the podcast, I almost feel a bit like a Rosemary Pangborn soldier. She was the one kind of really keeping intensities and preferences separate, right?
Right.
And she was from UC Davis and did this work in the 70s and 80s. And for me, that's all I want to do, pretty much. And we are just so far from this being the case. So I love that this is one of the first projects that kind of helps the community understanding that difference and in a very specific way. And this is where, as you might also have noticed in the podcast, that I've actually just done a podcast this morning with professor in sensory science at Copenhagen University, Venter, where we are talking about this SCA coping form, where he's kind of very diplomatic and insisting on the history and all that, that it has its place, but it's just, it has its place, but that might only be in 3% of the cases where it's used, where the other 97%, it doesn't. And this is and this is where, because it lacks the differentiation between intensities and preferences, which is fair enough in some contexts, but very few. And it's kind of used as the default method, even though it typically doesn't really fit the purpose. And this is in my podcast, I have this form follow functions that before you choose a method, you need to make sure that the method you choose answers the questions that you're pursuing in the project.
Yes.
So I don't know if you, and so this leads to the next question that I did ask you also to talk about, which I know you can talk about if I wake you up at 2 at night, which is, could you tell us a bit about the work that you're doing with the new revision of the way the community should put data on coffees?
So I think so if we're talking about the cupping form, as we are, I do think with respect to the conversation you had, I do want to touch on the history of cupping just a little bit, which is I won't go too deep into it, but basically the cupping methodology that we have now was developed for use by coffee experts in the trade, and to sort of apply some methodology to the traditional act of coffee tasting. That was the goal. And it was this happened in the late 90s and early 2000s. And it was an effort to get everybody tasting coffee the same way, because at the time, you know, they did it differently in the United States from the way they did it in Kenya, from the way they did it, you know, and the goal was to create a common language. Since the output though is a number, that number is an important thing, and the choice of a 100-point number was closely related to the wine scoring tradition. You know, the Robert Parker score, which at that time, especially, it still exists now, was very influential in the wine market. You know, a bottle of wine would show its little hang tag with its number, with its Parker score, and that was important. So that was part of the idea. But the existence of a number to any quantitative thinker made them think, that is a measure of the quality of the coffee. That is a quantitative measure of this idea of quality. The problem, as you know, and you've pointed out, is it conflated actually three kinds of information. And when I teach about this, I, like you, as a soldier for Professor Pangborn, I share your admiration for her foundational work on this, which is, okay, here's a sentence that one might say in a, you might say this in the coffee, in a coffee tasting room, where you'd say, hey, there were three coffees. I like the third one the best. It was floral and it was sweet. It was the best one out of the three. Okay. So that sentence actually has three kinds of information in it. It has discriminative information, right? Because it implies, hey, I tasted three coffees and I could tell the difference between the three, right? So that's implied in that conversation. It also has some descriptive information in it. It was floral and sweet. That third coffee was floral and sweet. That's a descriptive information. And then the third one, I liked it the best and it was the highest quality. That's an effective claim. That is about how the coffee either makes me feel I liked it the best or some other opinion that I have about where it sits in the marketplace. It was the highest quality. So the key to modern sensory science is that those are three different kinds of claims that need three different kinds of tests. You need a discriminative test to identify if you can tell the difference between coffee samples, food samples, in this case, coffee. You can do a descriptive test that allows you to describe neutrally the attributes, the sensory attributes of that food. And then you need a so-called effective test to know anything about quality or preference. Now, the cupping methodology as it was designed 20 years ago includes all three of those in one form. And the fundamental principle of sensory science is, as you just expressed it, if you're going to use the right tool for the job, you can't have them all mixed up together. You have to disaggregate those things. And so that is, I think, the key understanding that I've had as a student of sensory science over the past decade, you know, that, oh, wait, that's one reason why, you know, and you made the point on your podcast about the SCA cupping form, that it gives you preference data, which is effective data. And that's true, although it also has some descriptive data in there as well. And but the presence of that descriptive data makes you think that the whole project is descriptive in a way. And that is the key misunderstanding, I think, about the SCA form, is the output is actually mostly preference.
Yeah, and this is where I think, well, it has its place, a few places perhaps in specific context where you're not trying to kind of make universal claims. But it's really important that we kind of confine it to those. And I get asked to be a peer in the peer review processes frequently. And when I see the SCA cupping form being used as a quality endpoint for some chemical data, I'm just, no. Take out that. If there's something left, you have an article. If you don't, that's nothing, right?
Well, I agree. I mean,
because it's not a suitable method for that reason in any research, unless you're trying to, you could try to investigate the cupping form, but then that's the purpose of the research, right?
Right, right. I agree with you that a lot of times, you made the observation in your thing on the SCA cupping form is that like a chemistry paper that's trying to infer the impact of certain chemicals on the quality, overall quality of coffee is making a mistake if it uses the SCA form to try to measure quality. And that's true if you're thinking about quality as a descriptive thing, you know, if you're, and I think this is key to the understanding is what are we talking about when we're talking about quality? It's our instinct and many people's instinct to think that there's an obvious quality spectrum. When in fact, particularly as you get into the specialty realm, ideas about quality are very, very related, are much more effective than they are descriptive.
They are effective. So what you are, but the problem is, you'll not, the problem is that, okay, let's say that if you are correlating chemical data to some cupping form data, the problem is they are not objective in the sense of objectivity that if you repeat the same experiment once more with different people, that's the criteria. It has to be well enough right. described so somebody else could do the same and get to the similar conclusion. That is not the case with the cupping form because you will get some other random people with different preferences.
Right. And so you could treat it as you're talking about treating it as if it was descriptive data. But if you treated it as if they
no, was even if you data, accept that it's hedonic.
What's that?
Even if you accept that it's hedonic data.
Well, if you accept that it's hedonic data, then what you would do is apply a tool like clustering. And then you would see, and you also need a bigger number.
Well, yeah. That's the point, yeah, because, and that's the point is, the cupping score data says more about the people tasting than the product. Only the descriptive says exactly. something about the product. And exactly. But then you need to do a proper consumer study, which means minimum 100,
right,
with described so, demographics and geographics and psychographics, so that you can interpret the data in the light of the demographic, psychographic, and geographics.
Yeah. I think the thing that we definitely agree on is you have to have the right tool for the job.
So yeah, exactly.
So we just talked about this brewing study that we just did. We never used cupping in that entire project. In the cold brew thing we're doing right now, we're not using cupping in that entire project. Yeah. And that's because it's the wrong tool.
Exactly.
Now the question is it ever the right tool for anything? And I think the thing that you may have missed in your criticism is that it's that, okay, there's a descriptive panel that can tell you about the sensory attributes that exist in the coffee. And then you can do consumer work where you're looking at the end consumer. You know, there's a third category that you might be interested in. And this came up in your conversations with, particularly with Tim Wendelboe, which is there a role for the expert and their preferences, which may not align with consumer preferences?
Well, for me, that's just another consumer segment.
Okay, that's fine. I accept that too. I happen to agree with you that you treat experts as a consumer segment.
From a method perspective.
Right.
Because I also prefer Tim Wendelboe's coffee over some random supermarket coffee. Right. So it's not that I disagree on that, but it's from a method perspective. It's just another consumer's.
I totally agree. I totally agree. You use the tools, you treat them as they're a consumer segment, but you know, you understand that they're a different kind of consumer because, and a specific kind of consumer. And it's not, because it's important in coffee because these experts are sort of stand in between the producer and the consumer. Now, sometimes a coffee buyer, you know, I worked as a coffee buyer for many years, coffee roaster, whatever, is trying, sometimes they see their job as trying to understand consumer preferences and trying to buy and roast coffee that satisfy those consumer preferences. That happens. But also things like Tim was talking about, where he's standing in between the producer and the consumer, and he's trying to create coffee that is some sort of ideal vision that he sees, and then sort of educate the consumer about and expose them to something different.
Yeah.
And those are two different aims. They're compatible with each other. A single company can do both things, but you would use different, they're not necessarily, one is not necessarily entirely more important than the other. I think in specialty coffee, we got really interested in the expert idea and this idea that that our job is to understand coffee and build a vision for coffee and then educate the consumer. And that works sometimes, but it also, the pitfall there is it can fall into disrespecting coffee consumers and, and even ignoring them.
Which is happening a lot.
Which has happened a lot. Absolutely. And I think that that's really important to me for us to respect the preferences of consumers, maybe traditionally more than we have. I also, by the way, Morten, think that this is something that this is one of the silver linings of COVID, because I've noticed that a lot of coffee companies, because that survived COVID, have a lot more sort of respect for their consumers than they did before, you know? And it's, because it was consumers who rallied around these companies and kept them alive during the darkest moments of the COVID thing. And I heard so many coffee company leaders saying to me, you know, Peter, you know, 5 years ago, it seemed really important for us to educate consumers on and tell them what good coffee was. Now I just want to make them happy, you know? And I think that is something that's changing for the better. I'm hearing that more from coffee experts now that is more in, it's more interested in what the consumers want and also more respectful of diversity. More respectful that not everybody is going to like the same coffee.
It's the way I see it and the way I operate when I consult is that you've got, and I've actually thought a lot about this specifically after the episode with Tim, because that was one of the things he kind of addressed, that he didn't want to be told what to do by a consumer study, right?
Right.
And I agree. But so the way I see it is that you've got how the coffee tastes on the descriptive. Then you've got your consumer study. And then you have strategy. Because my point is, so either you are collecting the same consumers that has the same preferences as you, right? Like Tim does. And then if he finds out that, okay, that's not enough to sustain my business, then his response is education. So he's bridging the gap with education, which I think it's a brilliant way of doing it. Mm-hmm. And it's also the patient model, right? That's great. But he would still need to know where they are, or he would be better off if he knows where they are. So let's say he prefers, just to make it simple, right? If he prefers Acron 120, which is the lightest most apparatuses can measure, mm-hmm. and people are at Acron 35, like on Starbucks, right? Then he needs to develop different teaching material than if they are on Acron 75.
That's right.
So my point is, just because you map out what the consumers want, you don't need to give it to them. But exactly. Knowing where they are, you can either create different teaching material or different transition products, as I call it, if you want to educate them by creating different products. So my point is, consumer study doesn't kill creativity or just make you sell toys for kids or whatever you do. That could also be fun, I'm sure. Or something even unethical, right?
Yeah.
It's just knowing where your customers are cannot hurt your strategy. You need to know, how does my coffees taste? Where are my consumers? Even stratify them, as you talk about in cluster. And then when you have all those data, then comes your strategy. If it's Tim, I want it my way. And I really respect and love his coffee. So it's definitely a positive thing. But the world is much bigger, right, than only one business vision. We can have different. And then we need all the data in order to make the decision where we want to sit with our business in this landscape.
Yeah, so I agree with you. With you completely. I think there are a few business models. I have another friend who's a restaurateur who talks about this, and he doesn't work in coffee. He works in food, but he has a similar issue. And one thing that he says is, if I know what my consumers like and I know what I want them to like, then what I can do is I can give them what they ask for, but then I can also ask them to try what I like, you know, and you create some trust by giving them what they want. And then you ask them to accept what you want them to accept. And it's sort of a negotiation. So that's another alternative to the education model, where you can sort of have a give and take between your
No, but that is the education, what you just mentioned, right? That's education.
Maybe, if you want to call it that, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think sometimes education comes across as sort of like a school teacher. Like, you're wrong in your preferences, and we're going to teach you what's right. And I think that's a mistake. I think you have to start by respecting what people like. And I think that's the important concept behind the distinction between descriptive and effective, you know, because, and I'm being careful not to use objective and subjective, because I heard your discomfort with those terms, you know, but what I think is important, and I think was implicit in what you were saying, is one of those isn't, like, there's some people that say, well, objective is right and subjective is wrong, you know, or subjective is fallacious. And that's not true. And that's why using effective and descriptive are good analogs here, because they're both important and they're both measurable. They're different from each other, but they both have their place. That's really important. So just if you're saying something, some data is effective data, or an opinion is based on effective information, that's not an insult. That is, you're just choosing a lens with which to look at the world. You're looking at people's preferences. You're looking at the people rather than the product.
Exactly. Descript-
yeah.
But and you're so, still looking at the product through people when you do a descriptive analysis. And that was my point in the podcast. Let's just stop talking about objectivity and subjectivity as the inner and outer world. Let's just talk about reported first-person data about preferences when it's consumer, and reported first-person data about intensities when it's lab work, right? And then it's objective, is the proper method is applied.
Right.
That's it. Because then anybody doing the same would get the same conclusion, and that's objectivity. So that was kind of my suggestion.
I'm cool with all that. But I think that the key element is, I think this is really important, and I think you do too, and I think we're allied in this, is that it's really important that coffee quality people who are in the specialty coffee world, who taste coffee for a living, really understand this distinction between a descriptive activity and an effective activity. And this is, I think, a fundamental issue in our cupping methodology. And so one thing we did, you know, you asked about how we've been thinking about this and working with this lately. One thing we did a little over a year ago is ask 1500 cuppers a bunch of questions about how they use the form. And we got some really interesting and very technical information about it. But on this question, this bit of confusion comes through. And in fact, there was a bimodal distribution when we asked about objectivity and subjectivity of the form. So what that says to me is that the way forward here, and I think most sensory science, in fact, I know that most sensory scientists would agree with me, that the next logical step would be to disaggregate the effective, to design a form that's overtly effective, and that everybody knows is effective. And it's very clear that you're talking about preferences or ideas about quality or you know, impressions of quality, and a descriptive activity that's about describing, as you say, intensities or identifying specific flavors, which is meant to be neutral. Now, the question becomes, can professional cuppers do both of those activities? Can a professional cupper act as sort of a quasi descriptive panelist? And also then switch from being a descriptive kind of panelist who's describing flavors, and then switch at a different time to do an effective assessment of coffee. And that's what we're testing right now. Is My colleague, Mario Fernandez, do you know Mario?
Yeah, I don't know him personally, but I heard his name.
Yeah, so this is actually what he did his PhD on, is looking at cuppers, coffee cuppers, whether their descriptive information could be relied upon. And this is in the same way that you use a descriptive panel. And
but there's a big difference, because when you do a descriptive analysis at the university, you are not claiming any universality about the intensities you are reporting. You are only claiming intensity difference between the samples at hand. And that's a big difference. So let's say that I do a research project about different development times in coffee roasting, uh-huh. and I find out that the shortest one, shortest development time, has a higher intensity of acidity. Okay. Then the truth coming from this project is only that it's more intense than the longer development time. But I cannot infer, I cannot take any data from the project and kind of score and take the intensity scored by the panel on the shortest development time and kind of compare it to another study. Because I know this is what was attempted with the, or is kind of done with the lexicon, right? Where you have some kind of universal scales. And I think that's a great method and it works, but it's not necessarily what's important in a descriptive analysis. It's more that you're comparing the samples at hand rather than trying to, because that becomes the problem, right? If you're trying to develop a method where you can compare something in Copenhagen and South Korea, then you would have to have some samples distributed to kind of calibrate people.
Well, right. I mean, you do that. That's one of the important, at this point we're talking about universal sensory quantitative descriptive analysis.
Yeah.
And then the most well-known method is the sensory spectrum method that was developed by sensory spectrum. That's Gail Saville. Okay. And the technique there is exactly what you're saying is not important or difficult. I guess I disagree with you when you say, oh, wait, it's only about comparing intensities of samples within a specific study. Okay, that's important, but it's not always the most important thing. Descriptive is also, you can also use a technique like the spectrum method to look at a coffee, analyze its sensory attributes from a lexicon, a dictionary of possible sensory attributes, rate their intensities, and then compare that across other information. And yeah. they've shown actually that sensory panelists, when they're trained using a strong training method, like which relies on having available references between two, can perform extremely well even across cultures. So they've done studies with a panel in the US versus a panel in Thailand, or a panel in the US versus a panel in Spain. And the cool thing about quantitative sensory analysis is you can compare those.
They
replicate.
But you would have to have a very rigid way of calibrating the panelists before trusting the data. That's my point.
Right. And that's where references come in.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, and that's Ida's work, right? Ida's shown that training helps.
That's true. I think from a practical point of view, I think this is more interesting for scientists than people in, for example, if I'm going to select coffees for a specific product range for a client, I would just kind of pick some greens that I know is relevant, and then I would just score them individually. I wouldn't really concern my. I would actually take the most acidic on the table, and I would just put 10 if that's the highest, and the lowest I would put 0 because sure. I'm interested in the relative differences here. I'm not really concerned about the research. So this is where I think again where where you need to kind of make sure to use the right method, right? Form follows right. function, that we need to kind of easy now tell the community, you don't need to concern yourself with these universal scales because you can just score in, for the context purpose that you are in right now. And which I think that's an important point.
Which is an effective thing.
Yeah.
So again, I think the important insight here is to separate the effective task from the descriptive task.
Yes.
And the question, and as I said, the thing that we're interested in knowing and testing, but there's some indication that this might be that this is promising, is that we can trust descriptive data from coffee tasters, as well as, now it may not be as good as that when you get from a dedicated descriptive panel, but whether and there's some promising things. So right now, you know, you can collect some descriptive data in the cupping form, right? Like, for example, you can, even though it's not scored, there's a little space for intensity of acidity.
Yes. Yeah.
And then there's the open lines where people write, you know, lemon or plum or, you know, whatever they write. That's descriptive. That's them trying to be descriptive. Now, it's not rigorous right now. Yeah. But if you apply some rigor to it, in other words, which would include limiting the number of possible choices and having references available for those choices, yeah. and really work on, and I want to use this word carefully, calibration, because we use it in a bunch of different ways in coffee. But when I say calibration, I'm talking about you and I deciding, taking a reference together that's, let's say it's vanilla, and you and I agreeing that this is what vanilla tastes like, and this is what the intensity of this sample of vanilla is. That's what calibration means in the descriptive sense.
Yes.
Not that we're going to agree about how good that vanilla is. No. That's a different use of the term. I would call that more consensus building than calibration. Calibration is we have a reference standard and we're agreeing on where we are with it. That's how you use the term calibration in an instrument. And the thing with descriptive analysis is you're using humans and treating them like instruments.
Yes.
And so anyway, back to the SCA cupping. That's a question, is whether we can treat, how seriously can we treat descriptive data coming from cuppers? That's an empirical question. And we can have our opinions about that, but there's an empirical question there. But then the other thing that I think you and I would agree is to really embrace the effective data, treat it as effective data, train people to know that it's effective data, which hasn't been so clear always in the past, and teach people how to understand and process effective information, which is as most often used in consumer research, and do more consumer research. You know,
that's Peter here. Rosemary Pangborn speaking through us, right?
Right.
This is where I haven't been involved much in what's going on in the kind of global business, but I've been thinking a bit, what has taken us so long, right? It's in the 70s.
Yeah.
and this is kind of, if you hear any kind of an element of annoyance in my podcast, that's come on, we need to kind of get moving on this, right? It's we cannot confuse ourselves too much about all this. It's not that difficult. It's already solved many years ago. So this is where I really want to kind of.
I think there are some interesting cultural reasons why it took us so long. In the wine world, they have not embraced this approach. You know, the Pangborn approach, they struggle with this, you know, all the time. And a lot of it has to do with this idea of of culture and almost this idea of good taste being a social good. You know, if I have refined taste or good taste, then I am a little bit more elite. I'm, and this comes from, you know, European aristocratic, you know, ideas in like England and stuff, where if you had good taste in wine, you were likely to be from the upper classes. And so I think that attitude that there's something about enlightened taste, so to speak, can kind of mess with us here. Whereas, yeah. You know, who the people that have embraced the food science fundamentals the most have been the big food companies, you know, who really understand consumer liking, and they design products. You know, when they design Doritos, you know, the new thing of Doritos, they know exactly who they're aiming at, you know, and they know exactly how much they're going to like that. And sure enough, we like it so much, we can sit down in front of the TV and eat a whole bag, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think it's rightful that especially coffee people sometimes have a little bit of distrust about food science because it can be so industrial in its application. But I think, and you were just talking about this when we were talking about how Tim Wendelboe would be benefited if he knew his consumer preferences, even though his project is not to pander to them, even though his project is to just understand who his audience is and do something different. I think that's the real enlightened approach of how to use sensory and consumer science.
Exactly, because you shouldn't judge the big companies for their strategy, because that's just what they have. But the methods they're using, we could still use for, with their different strategy, right?
Exactly.
I want to kind of disentangle the consumer science from this industrial approach, which it can do so much more.
I agree completely, but I think that's why it took, you know, 30 years.
But there's an interesting thing you're saying here, and that this is something I'm becoming more and more aware of, because in a story you have the hero and the guide, right? So you've got Luke Skywalker and Yoda or Gandalf and is it Frodo?
Yeah.
So everybody wants to be Luke Skywalker, even educators. And this is where I think as an educator, you should play the role as the guide rather than you want to be the hero. And there's a lot of educators out there who wants to be the hero, and they want to stay on top of the mountain. And I think, so Yoda, he would go down to the bottom and help people get up, right? But so there's an assumption that there's this, and this is where the SCA copying form is not really helping a kind of dismantle this. Because if somebody claims, as you said, the aristocrats, I know what the good taste is, and I'll just kind of tell you what to do, because there's only one true, and that's the kind of, the SCA copying form is the altitude of the mountain, right? Then that's really not helping giving a bit more kind of actionable way of, oh, there's a lot of mountains and I want to help you to find the mountain that you want to climb rather than assume that the one I'm standing on is the right one. So it's a bit of this kind of, everybody wants to be the hero. And that's a bit of a problem in the specialty coffee business, because we can't all be. And I think being the helpers or the guides would be more beneficial for the community if we got more guides than heroes.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with your principle. I think that the SCA cupping methodology and form of, I'm not sure that it was originally designed the way that you just
I'm just saying it's not helping.
Right. And I think we can, and what we're interested in doing at SAA is through critical evaluation of the form and some judicious adjustments in not only the form itself, but also how it's taught. Then I think it can regain that utility and not have that trapdoor that you're talking about.
I'm so excited that you're developing the new ones, because we need some alternatives then, right? Because if there's only one form, why would people use something else, right?
right. There's one thing I will always advocate though for is this idea of the universal language. And that's not to say that there can't be variation. There should be. But it is very useful. And this has been an amazing success of the SCA form, is that right now, today, I can get on a plane and fly to Rwanda and be in a room with people that we have a fundamental language that's in common with each other, you know. And now we could improve our definitions of terms and all that stuff. I'm not saying it's perfect, but oh my gosh, it is so much better than it used to be, you know. When you would fly, I did this, the first time I went to Kenya I went into a room to taste coffees. They were preparing the samples completely different. They had a completely different paradigm of scoring, you know, and that's fine, except we had to spend a day deciding what our shared terminology was. If we can pre-train, you know, if we can pre-train everybody to just have a basic fundamental language, you know, that doesn't mean that there can't be other things outside of that. But if we're all going to decide, okay, a meter is a meter, you know, the meter is a great example of this. Meter, you know, this idea came from France, but now the whole world observes the meter. Now we have feet in inches as well in the US, and that kind of sucks. But if we're going to communicate, if I'm going to communicate with you, I need to know what a meter is and what a kilo is and what a degree Celsius is. And that's the positive thing about a common language.
Which is great. And the downside is that there's also a huge element of power in this. And I'm pretty sure that there's a lot of copying scores magically being gained during transportation from the negotiation with the with the farmer to you selling the coffees for your consumers, right? Mm-hmm. And if you saw the data that I extracted from the freshness, it was all over the place. The import score was just so much higher. It wasn't even part of the 95 confidence interval, and the average was below the 80, right? And the importer said 83.5 or what. Yeah. So it's great with a common language, but we have to really be careful how that can be used in kind of power
games. I totally agree. I share that suspicion. And in fact, years ago when I was a coffee buyer, I used to pay according to my cupping scores. You know, it was a whole system. But over time, I realized, wait, this cupping methodology is not accurate enough to base actual economic. So I stopped doing that. But so we share that. But here's something that's interesting that came out of the study that we did, the survey of 1500 cuppers that I just told you we did. We asked this question about does the cupping system benefit or not benefit coffee producers? And here was the interesting thing. Most of the buyers, like you and me on the consuming side of things, sort of suspected that the cupping method might not benefit coffee producers. But you know who disagreed? The coffee producers who responded. They actually saw, and this is not our expectation, they actually saw the cupping method, the current cupping method, as empowering. And now that's not to say that it's perfect.
But that's an important part of information that you cannot ignore, right?
Right, exactly.
that's interesting.
And I do think I agree with you that it's a problem. The other interesting thing that we learned is that a huge number of specialty coffee contracts, maybe even over 90%, are making reference to the cupping score at some place. Yeah. And that's like, wow, we didn't expect that at all. Yeah. And I think I agree with you that if it's like, if you're going to make a contract that says you're going to deliver me an 85 point coffee and I get to decide what an 85 point coffee is, that's obviously there's another kind of contract called subject to approval of sample, no approval, no sale, which is basically the customer gets to reject it at any point. That's really what that is. When you say it's an 85 and I get to decide what an 85 is, that's really, I get to reject the coffee for any reason I see fit.
Yeah.
And it may create an impression with some people that there's some third party out there who can decide. And sometimes they do that. You know, I mean, there is a way that you can send samples to Q graders, have them score it, and you can use that as the arbiter of what it is. And some people do that.
I would send to 10 different Q graders and then hope for the average to be useful.
Right. That's right. That's possible. I think the point is, if you understand that, if we all understand that that is actually an effective measure.
Yeah.
Then you're less likely, you have a better understanding of what that actually means on the contract.
Yeah. And this is where I think the methods that encourages everybody in our community to be more concerned about the local preferences in their specific business than universal scales will get a stronger community.
I agree. Understand flavor profile as being universal, you know, because sensory attributes, descriptive attributes, that can be universal.
Yeah,
and that's a good
definitely.
Thing.
Yeah.
And then the second thing, and I don't want to ignore this, and you mentioned it earlier, which is, but then when you're valuing coffee, when you're actually valuing coffee in the marketplace, you've got to include those other attributes besides the sensory ones. Like the place that it came from.
Yeah, sure.
All those extrinsic attributes too.
Yeah.
And I think that's also important to us in this, is not only to disaggregate the descriptive and the effective, but also include these extrinsic attributes as a place where the coffee is valued. And that's our next step, you know?
Yeah. And then that's basically your point in the white paper. And I think that's really a great model. And that taps into microeconomics. It's really a solid way of understanding things that has also been around for many years. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I really think that I think that's amazing. And that's exactly also what we have been If you know these theories, you kind of want them to get into the hands of the community. And that's kind of the impatience behind my podcast, that I really want this to soon kind of benefit. Because it's, in a sense, it's not rocket science. It's been around for a long time. So I really want to help whatever I can to speed this up.
Thank you. Yeah.
So I'm really happy to, now that we've been through all these things, that it seems like we are not more aligned than I feared, but we are just completely aligned.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and I think, I told you, I wrote you a note a while ago that I really appreciated your position. I appreciate the gadfly kind of approach, you know, because that helps us. At the same time, though, and this also came through when we surveyed people, is, you know, we have to be an inclusive, especially SCA has to be an inclusive organization. And that means that we have a responsibility. And one of the things that people said to us, the Cuppers said to us, is don't change for no reason. And we're open to change, but we don't want you to just change for the sake of changing, and let us keep up. You know, because, and this is particularly true in producing countries, you know, I've cupped with a lot of people in exporting offices in producing countries, and it's really an important professional skill that they have to be able to cup with a buyer when they come into town, you know, and we want to make sure that we just don't change the rules on them one day. And then it's like, okay, sorry, it's different now. Mm-hmm. And that's where education, communication, transparency is so important, and why it might move frustratingly slow sometimes, you know, because we've all got to get there at the same time, you know.
But this actually ties a bit into kind of my second questions. I'm aware that I've already taken an hour of your time now, because it ties a bit into, I think, with my scientific background, and you can hear that in the podcast, I think that we just have so much what Popper would call pseudoscience, that I found there's a term called bro science that I found recently. That's it's a modern way of saying the same, or what Plato would call sophism. Mm-hmm. That there's just so much out there where people use scientific concept in a wrong concept, and this is just and where do you see? I appreciate you are diplomatic, and you have as an organization you have to be that. But where does myth busting come into the kind of the strategy of the SCH research and the collaboration with UC Davis? Because we can also be too diplomatic to not right?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. You'll see me on different days be different about this. I mean, sometimes it drives me crazy, honestly. You know, I mean, somebody will put a blog post up of, you know, so one problem is we use terms like experiment and theory differently in common language than we do in the scientific realm, you know? So people might use the term experiment to say, hey, I went into my, you know, roasting thing. I messed with a bunch of variables. I found something that worked for me. And those were my experiments. And then I came out with something that was good for my business. So I'm going with it. That they use that term experiment, and experiment sort of conjures up science ideas in people's minds. But of course, that was not a scientific project. That was messing around until you found something that worked and going with it. But that's not the scientific method. A scientific experiment has to do with lots of rigor, you know, things like considering bias, minimizing bias, you know, understanding of the statistics. You know, you talk about p-values a lot when you're talking about in this series. And most people don't even understand statistics to the point of understanding statistical significance, you know. And you can't understand science without understanding that. So, and this is where I think a lot of this bro science, as you call it, falls down, is they collect data, but then they don't apply rigorous statistical methods to understanding the data.
I hope with my podcast to have made this 8-point model so that people can see that it's actually not more complicated than that. And the p-value is just a mathematical way of being self-critic. Right. So as long as you are self-critic, you can do a lot of things where you don't need to really calculate. Yeah. And also, if you go and do drum speed experiments, please make sure that you end up at the same color. Right. So it's really small things like this. It doesn't need to be really advanced statistics or really... the rigorousness doesn't really go beyond the scope of the 8 points that I've... And it's basically just 8 points of common sense when you think about it. So I think that the scientific method is much more within reach than most people think it is.
Oh, I agree. I totally agree with that. I mean, the so as I say, sometimes it drives me crazy. Other times I am more diplomatic about it because I know that people come to it honestly. And they are really trying to... you know, learn something and share something that they learned with the world. But they've just made some basic, easily corrected mistakes.
Exactly.
You know, with your talk with Andrew, I was impressed with him. He was describing where they were varying pressure on their espresso machine. And noticed that people liked, you know, lower pressure, but then they realized that they were actually varying the TDS. It didn't have anything to do with channeling, you know.
Exactly.
And that's great. That's like, oh wait, we weren't keeping everything the same.
Yeah.
And so that's an example of somebody who's, I don't think he's a scientist, trained in sciences, but he's applying. Yeah.
Environmental scientist.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So he's applying some methodology there. And I think, here's my feeling is that, and this is one of the reasons why the Coffee Science Foundation exists. We operated in specialty coffee in a vacuum of empirical information about specialty coffee. And a lot of the empirical scientific study of coffee that existed was not available to, you know, entrepreneurs. But through institutions like the Coffee Science Foundation, projects like you're doing, it's becoming more and more available to entrepreneurs. And to build, you know, I strongly believe, and I think this is something that you and I are really, really strongly aligned on, is that a business that's built on empiricism is a much stronger idea than a business that's built on something like tradition or you know, sort of received wisdom.
Yeah, the big companies prove that point, right?
Yeah.
But and then my point in my podcast is that it's just a few simple principles that you need to apply. Right. So it's actually within
absolutely. I do believe it's within it. You know, if I can, you know, I'm a simple person, you know, and if I can understand and organize, and I'm not a scientist, but if I can understand through some basic reading and training and insights, if I can understand these things and apply them to the real world of coffee, then anyone can, you know, and I do believe that anyone can.
But I think education is really important here. So we are talking about this myth busting or kind of finding pseudoscience. So what is the strategy from the foundation and also the universities involved to kind of start to kind of spend time on myth busting rather than creating new research?
Yeah, well, okay. I'll give you a few examples that we've already done and then sort of what we hope happens. So that early project that we were talking about, looking at coffee brewing fundamentals, you know, what we were doing was we were looking at the received wisdom of Lockhart from the 1950s and 60s, which had become, you know, etched on stone tablets, the truth that was handed down, you know. And we were open to disproving some of those hypotheses. And we did. One of them was the box in the middle of the brewing control chart. You know, what we showed is that probably is not a good way of thinking about coffee. And that allows us to revise the brewing control chart and eliminate that. Okay. So that's a kind of myth busting. However, we were able to confirm the hypothesis that TDS is really important in coffee flavor. And that was, and second, percentage of extraction, the amount of extraction. That was Lockhart's insight in 1958. And we strongly confirmed that, because what we noticed is those two outputs, those two things drove both consumer and descriptive information more than any other thing.
Yeah.
Except roast. Roast is always the strongest. At a given roast, TDS and percentage extraction is more important than temperature. It's more important than grind size. It's more important. Yeah. So in that case, we didn't myth bust. We confirmed the conventional wisdom.
Well, with the possibility of myth busting in case what you found.
Exactly.
So you are testing the, yeah. So exactly. It is myth busting, or at least testing the myths.
Myth testing, let's call it.
With the possibility of busting if it doesn't keep up.
And we're doing the same thing now with cold brew. You know, people have a lot of ideas of the impacts that water temperature has on sensory attributes. Well, we're testing those things. So I think, and then we're publishing them. And when we talk about it, I hope we're clear on communicating not only the outputs, but also the method that we use to get there.
Yeah.
Because that's where the proof is in the pudding, right? But then the important thing, and I think you're mentioning this, is then it has to leak out into our educational material. And so, you know, that's where educational tools, you know, Mario and I wrote that sensory handbook. There's right now being written a new coffee brewer's handbook, you know, and those things, those texts become integrated into educational material. It takes time. But then I think my personal goal is that an increased understanding and respect for empiricism in coffee claims itself will kind of weaken the foundations of some of the broadly accepted myths that we have. And yeah. So the myth-busting attitude can be a lot more pervasive.
And with the new approach to cupping, perhaps we can have, you know, Occam's razor that I talked about. Perhaps we should mm-hmm. develop Pangborn's razor to kind yeah. of shave off the curriculum for the century.
I love that idea. And I got to say, Morten, I'm so pleased that you brought up Pangborn because, it's so meaningful to me that the work that she did, you know, decades ago is so relevant to us.
Yeah.
And, you know, whenever we do this event called the Sensory Summit, you know, and twice now I've opened up the event with a reflection on who this person was. Yeah. And because not only was she a brilliant innovator in terms of method and stuff, she was also a wonderful teacher. And, you know, many of the sensory scientists that I've worked with and learned from were in fact students of hers. You know,
yeah,
and so that's inspiring to me that a woman who was born in New Mexico to Mexican immigrants really transformed the world in such a way that you in Copenhagen and me in Southern California can be reflecting decades later on the yeah. power of that. I think that's really cool.
Of the distinctions that she's made, she made, and yeah. Yeah, and Venda, the professor at sensory science here in Copenhagen, he's been at UC Davis during his PhD, so he's mm-hmm. completely aligned with all this. So that's I also have it from him.
Cool.
So, okay, but Peter, I really appreciate that you, first of all, listened to my podcast.
I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it.
Okay, thanks a lot. That was the first big thing I wanted to thank you for. And then obviously also to take the time here. You've been really responsive. It's actually me who's been a bit difficult to reach here. So thank you so much for really wanting to take time out to speak with me about this. I really enjoyed it.
Me
and,
too.
And sometimes with a big organization, you kind of, what's going on really, right? So it's really nice to speak with you to understand where you know your perspective and what's to expect it from the future. So to be honest, I wasn't expecting us to be this aligned, but I also say this in the podcast that this is what everything that Ida's and I have been speaking about the last 8 years, but we've been a bit too polite to kind of put out there. So I was ready to get a lot of criticism and a lot of kind of pushback, which I would, as a scientist, I would mm-hmm. appreciate.
Sure.
But I think on all the podcasts, I've almost been a bit disappointed.
Yeah, I know the feeling.
Disagree more.
I felt that way when we published that white paper that we were talking about. You know, it's like a new idea. You want some pushback, or at least, yeah. And so, yeah, I think, look, I do think that there are some points. We did a lot of agreeing with each other on this podcast. I think there might be some places where we might find a little bit more constructive disagreement, let's say. And I would love to continue to explore that. Because I like you, I learn by having these kinds of discussions. And that's why I appreciate it. And that's why I wrote you that note after you did the podcast on the SCA forum. I appreciate the criticism. I think that's healthy. And I think, one thing I love about coffee is there's a sincere interest, and there has been my whole career, in improvement. You know, we wound up at SCA, we wound up with this motto, you know, kind of hashtag make coffee better, you know. That was originally the motto of the sustainability group, you know, but it's become the motto of our whole organization, because I know that that's what drives you, you know. I know that that's what drives Tim and Andrew and me and Ida, you know, and we're all using our skills to kind of make coffee better. And that's unlike a lot of other industries, you know. Yeah. The potato chip people don't sit around and like, you know, have podcasts and think in their shower about how they can make potato chips better. Yeah. And that's unique and special about coffee. And that's something that I love. And I appreciate, because I know that that's the spirit behind your podcast series, from a using scientific tools to make coffee better. And I think that's really cool.
So a last question about this myth-busting thing. So I do have a very specific question. So I noticed that at the Sensory Summit, you serve these different organic acids to people. And this is where we've been pretty skeptical since 2014 about the relevance and even the possibility from a sensory perspective. So what's your feeling about this?
Well, Ida came to the Sensory Summit a few years ago, and she did a great exercise that informed me, that busted my myths about that, you know. And, you know, I remember one of the things that she gave us, I think it was citric, malic, and tartaric acid, perhaps. Or I don't remember what the third one, but I remember citric and malic were included. And when she controlled the I'm not sure if she was controlling the pH or titratable acidity.
Yeah.
But they were indistinguishable. They were just sour, you know. And I remember what her focus was, you know, people taste, you know, people think malic acid tastes like apples, and they think citrus acid tastes like lemons, and they don't, they just both taste sour. And it's the aromatic attributes that cause us to interpret it as apple or, you know, green apple or lemon.
Well, it's the aromas that correlates with the presence of the acids, because the acids are not volatile, so they don't give
you exactly.
Any, yeah,
exactly. But then there are other acids like formic and acetic acid that are volatile. And there is, it's easy to distinguish acetic acid from citric acid. So what we weren't doing, I think you would have been happy with the way that we presented it, because it was largely informed by that exercise that Ida did, which is that we can't, all these acids exist in coffee, but you can't always, you know, they're not necessarily a diagnostic for anything. Exactly. But then there are a bunch of other acids too, the chlorogenic acids, which we can't do a tasting. It's harder to do tastings of chlorogenic acids, you know, but these are driving not necessarily sourness, although sometimes sourness, but also bitterness,
yeah,
and other flavors. And then you've got like isovaleric acid, butyric acid, these other, you know, acids that are, you know, isovaleric acid is like cheese, and butyric acid is like it's the Brettanomyces kind of wine barnyard smell. So anyway, acids are fascinating. I don't think we've moved on from the way we taught them a decade ago. And are now, I think, I mentioned her earlier, Sarah Yeager, who was one of the students at UC Davis that's now gone on to work at Toddy. She published a really cool review paper. I don't know if you've seen it.
I have. But
yeah. And that, I think that was really useful in understanding how these different acids work together. And also are the byproducts of things that people don't expect, like roasting.
But that paper is, and that's a meta-analysis, really. So it's looking into a lot of papers. But really, the data there is only Arabica against Robusta in green and roasted and not brewed coffee.
That's
and
right.
It's primarily chlorogenic acid. So it doesn't really zoom into all
acids.
These small... Yeah, but it doesn't really zoom into any differences between those. So it doesn't really inform anything in Arabica, in brewed coffee, when it comes to the small acids like acetic, formic, and all that.
Right.
Because according to some data we found, most of these are below threshold, and there's no kind of fingerprint between terroirs. So it's not even relevant, even if it was possible, right? It's below threshold. So there's a lot of...
Right. Well, that's a whole other thing, the threshold thing. Is true. I think acetic acid, maybe not formic, but acetic acid in particular is normally, I think, below threshold, except when it's not. you know, and then and then there's a tendency to respond strongly when it's not, which is the issue with so-called over-fermented coffees and other defects.
All right. But Peter, we could speak for days.
We could do this. Yeah. Well, thanks for having me on. I really enjoyed it and I appreciate the conversation.
I really love this conversation. And I really, again, want to thank you for being on this marginal show.
I love it. I really enjoyed it. Thank you for creating it.
Will I see you in Milan next week?
I will. I will be there.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yes, I'm leaving on Sunday. Yeah.
Great. All right.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Peter.
Talk more.
For sure.
Okay. Bye, Martin.
Take care. Bye.
You too.
Thanks.
Thank you for taking your time to listen to what we've created for you. If you want to implement some of our thoughts in your business, please go to our website, coffee-mind.com, where we are all set up for helping you as fast, affordable, and easy as possible through our automated e-learning courses starting as low as 30 euros, as well as our live virtual education programs, and of course also our on-site courses here in Denmark, and with our partner venues around the world where we will appear frequently. Use the filter bar on the front page of our website to find your learning experience of preference. Hope to see you soon.